This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. In just a bit, we'll talk with actress Julia Louis-Dreyfus about her role as the Vice President of the United States in the new HBO series Veep. But first, we're going to hear Terry's recent interview with Sissy Spacek. Spacek's new memoir, My Extraordinary Ordinary Life, describes growing up in a small Texas town, trying and failing to make it as a singer in New York, then breaking into movies. As an actress, Sissy Spacek has given many memorable performances. She was the outcast teenager who's pranked on prom night and covered with a bucket of pig blood in the film Carrie. She won an Oscar for her portrayal of Loretta Lynn in the 1980 film Coal Miner's Daughter. More recently, Spacek played a lobbyist in the HBO series Big Love and the mother of a racist young woman in the film The Help. Let's start with a clip from the 1973 film Badlands, in which Spacek plays a teenager in a small South Dakota town. She doesn't speak much, but she narrates the story of how she fell under the spell of a handsome young rebel named Kit, played by Martin Sheen, and became his accomplice in a killing spree. Here's part of her narration early in the film.
Kit went to work in the feedlot while I carried on with my studies. Little by little, we fell in love. As I'd never been popular in school and didn't have a lot of personality, I was surprised that he took such a liking to me, especially when he could have had any other girl in town if he'd given it half a try. He said that I was grand, though, that he wasn't interested in me for sex, and that coming from him, this was a compliment. He'd never met a 15-year-old girl who behaved more like a grown-up and wasn't giggly. He didn't care what anybody else thought. I looked good to him, and whatever I did was okay. And if I didn't have a lot to say, well, that was okay, too.
Sissy Spacek, welcome back to Fresh Air. It's really a pleasure to have you back on the show, and congratulations on the memoir.
Thank you.
The voiceover narration that we just heard from Badlands was actually recorded in the bedroom of the director, Terrence Malick. I was really surprised to read that. Was it hard to get into character, like, in somebody's house?
No, it was actually after we'd shot the film, and there were blankets. He had nailed blankets up on every wall. He was such an old friend by that time. And, you know, everything we did on that film was a little different than on a lot of films. We were all so new at it. We didn't know it was supposed to be done in a recording studio.
Now, you were told when you were getting started in show business that you should lose your Texas accent and come back when you were older. But your youth and your Texas accent were just what was needed for this role. How were you cast in it?
Well, there are a couple of stories that are circulating. Terry tells me that he was really meeting with a girlfriend of mine, and I was waiting in the car. And after an hour or so of her being inside, I knocked on the door. And I don't remember that, but it was in a big old house that he had rented from George Segal, where he was meeting with all the actors, and a big empty house, actually. He would give me little pieces of paper he would pull out of his pocket and hand them to me, and I would unroll them, and he'd have a line of dialogue. He'd have something written on them, and he would ask me to read them. And when I did, he would just laugh, and that was always a good sign with Terry. If something made him laugh, it meant he liked it.
It was such a life-changing movie for you because it was your first starring role, and also you fell in love with Jack Fisk, who was the set designer for that film and went on to become a very, very famous production designer in movies. And you've been married for many years since. When you started falling in love on this movie, did you try to keep it a secret from others? Or did everybody else know?
You know, I don't think we tried to keep it a secret, but and most everyone knew. Terry didn't know, but Terry was so focused on the film. My first date with Jack was, he asked me to take the boat home, a little rowboat, down the river back to the hotel or the motel where the whole crew was staying. And he had built this wonderful treehouse out among the cottonwoods. And it was just the most magical place. And I thought, oh, this is a great idea. No one has ever asked me to take a boat anywhere. So the whole crew left, knowing that we were going to take this boat trip about 10 miles back to the motel. And then a huge storm came, lightning and thunder and torrential rains, and the boat sank about 100 yards down the river. And the crew members were really nervous because the storm was so big. They sent out search parties for us. And, of course, we were so much in love. We were dodging the headlights. We would hide in the wet ditches when we would see headlights. And we finally made it back late that night. And we were dripping wet and just exhilarated. And we walked into the dining room where Terry was having tea and working on the script. And he looked up at us, gave us a beatific smile and said, "How was the boat trip?" So, you know, he had never been worried. He thought it was just, you know, when he finally heard about it, he thought it was wonderful. Everyone else had fallen to pieces, but we made it back.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Sissy Spacek, and she has a new memoir called My Extraordinary Ordinary Life. Let's talk about another film that made you famous, and this is Carrie. And you were 25 when you got the role, even though Carrie is a high school student, a very lonely high school student who's frequently bullied. She has telekinetic powers. She has a mother who's a religious zealot who's obsessed with sexual sin and punishment.
Piper Laurie was so amazing. She really gave that character something.
I want to play a clip with you and her. And, you know, in the beginning of the movie, you're in the shower after gym class, and it's a very lyrical scene and lovely music, and suddenly there's blood between your legs, and you don't understand what menstruation is, and this is like the first time you've started menstruating, and you're just in a panic seeing the blood. And you start screaming, and then, you know, all the girls are, like, laughing at you. And then you go home, and you tell your mother, played by Piper Laurie, what's happened and that the kids were laughing at you and that, you know, you want to know, how come you never told me about this? And this is just a really like frightening scene. You know, Piper Laurie, as your mother, picks up this book and starts reading from a chapter called The Sins of Women. And then she starts like hitting you on the head with it. And what we hear at the end of this scene is your mother dragging you into a closet and locking you up in it as punishment. So here's the scene with my guests, Sissy Spacek and Piper Laurie and Carrie.
The raven was called
Sin. Why didn't you tell me, Mama?
Say it.
No.
The raven was called Sin.
Ooh, woman. And the raven was called Sin.
And first sin was intercourse. First sin was intercourse.
I didn't sin, Mama.
No. Say it.
I didn't sin, Mama.
First sin was intercourse. First sin was intercourse. First sin was intercourse.
And the first sin was intercourse, Mama. I was so scared. I thought I was dying. And the girls, they all laughed at me and threw things at me.
And
Mama.
Eve was weak. Say it.
No, Mama.
Eve was weak.
No.
Eve was weak.
No.
Eve was weak. Say it.
No, Mama.
Say it.
Eve was weak. Eve was weak.
And the Lord visited Eve with a curse. And the curse was the curse of blood.
You should have told me, Mama. You should have told me.
Oh, Lord, help the sinning woman see the sin of her days and ways. Show her that if she had remained sinless, the curse of blood would never have come on her. She may have been tempted by the Antichrist. She may have committed the sin of lustful thoughts.
No, Mama,
oh, don't
no.
lie to me, Carrietta. Don't you know by now I can see inside you? I can see the sin as surely as God can.
No, you're
we'll pray.
No!
We'll pray,
no.
woman!
No!
Pray to
That's my guess. This is Spacek with Piper Laurie as her mother in a great scene from Carrie. And that's Sissy Spacek at the end banging on the closet door that her mother's just
God,
locked her in.
Disturbing.
Isn't it disturbing? Yeah, I know.
Oh,
and,
my gosh.
But it sounds like a duet. It almost sounds like music, the way you two are doing your parts together.
She was playing scenes with her and playing scenes with other actors is really like a dance. And we just both came in prepared and then it just became real for us. And we shot in a sound stage at Culver City Studios in Los Angeles, and you know, it's a huge, dark, cavernous building, and I was always lurking. You know, all the cast was having fun together, and I was, you know, lurking in the catacombs and the dark corners, the dark recesses of this building, kind of licking my wounds. And that was the time in my career where I stayed in character, and you know, so I I was really hamming it up.
So in the final scene, and if you haven't seen Carrie and you intend on seeing it soon, tune out for a couple of seconds. But in the final scene, after you've been, you know, dead and laid to rest, the Amy Irving character comes to visit your grave, and there's this beautiful music playing, and suddenly, like, your hand shoots out from beneath the earth. And everybody in the audience, like, screams or jumps. And you insisted, you know, the director, Brian De Palma, suggested getting, you know, like a stunt person, a body double to do that part, just like the hand coming out of the grave. But you insisted that, like, it be your hand and that you be buried. When you see the film with other people, as I suspect, but maybe you haven't done, are you glad it's your hand when you see people's reaction to that scene?
Oh, absolutely. I laughed, you know, about that, that I do all my own foot and hand work and always have. But, you know, I used to go to, and when I was in New York and Carrie came out, I would go to theaters just for the last 5 minutes of the film to watch everyone jump out of their chairs. Because if you know it's coming, you know, the film ends about, as Brian said, about 8 times. And so your people are all relaxed. The music is really beautiful and relaxing. And all of a sudden that comes up and people just go crazy. Although, my favorite scene in the film is the one where Carrie's mother is impaled with the kitchen utensils. That, I think, is one of the most wonderful and unique scenes. And it was done back then. She was rigged, and all of those kitchen utensils were sticking out of her. She was wearing a harness, and it was very...
Let me just explain that, what happened is your mother stabs you in the back with this big butcher knife, and then she makes a cross with the knife. And then using your telekinetic powers, you summon all the knives in the kitchen to kind of rise up and... float over and stab her. So she's impaled with all the kitchen knives through your telekinetic powers. So
obviously, and a couple of carrot peelers.
And yes, okay, yes. So that's the scene that you're describing.
Yes, and it was interesting because they shot it backwards and then they reversed the film. So they started, when we were shooting it, they started in her body and then were pulled out on wires to, you know, to the counter where the potato peeler was, and to the drawer where the knives were. And, you know, it's certainly not the way they do special effects now, but it just holds up so beautifully.
So you decided you wanted to perform when you were, I think, around 6, after seeing a little performance at a brick schoolhouse in Coke, Texas, which at the time had a population of 25 people. So after making that decision that you wanted to be in show business, you took baton twirling lessons, tap lessons. What did it mean to you to be able to twirl a baton with the marching band when you were in school?
Oh, that's what all young girls in this area, that's what we aspired to. That was the thing to do. Now, you know, when I've... In my adult life, when I've told my own daughters that, they just were horrified. You know, they played sports, but that wasn't really done back then. So we were either cheerleaders or majorettes. And I guess I liked the short shorts, Terry. I don't know. It seemed so important to wear those. You know, there's so much just to wear those white boots with jingle taps. When I did Crimes of the Heart with Beth Henley, she presented at the first day of filming, she presented to Diane Keaton and Jessica Lange and I a long red ribbon sewn in a circle with tiny little jingle bells all around it. And that was significant to her because all little, and it was significant to me because all little girls would have these jingle bells sewn into their petticoats when they were little. So jingle taps in the majorette boots and jingle bells on our petticoats were an important part of a little girl growing up in the South.
Yet you were a tomboy.
Yet I was a tomboy. Yep. But that was probably, I was probably a tomboy more because I had brothers who I idolized than any other reason. And they you know, for many years we all shared a room. And so I only had one tiny little corner for dolls and you know, girly things. So they were my playmates, and I grew up climbing trees and building forts and getting hit in the head with baseballs and, you know, trying to ride my bicycle after them, you know, going to the dump and going to the football stadium the morning after the ball games and looking for things that had dropped out of people's pockets. I got to do a lot of boy things. They made a man out of me, Terry.
So when you decided not to go to college but to just go to New York and try to have a career in show business, what you were initially seeking was a music career. You played guitar, you wrote songs, you sang songs. What exactly were you hoping for?
Oh, I think I wanted to be Joni Mitchell.
Okay, we got that. So you tried to get a recording contract. You recorded a couple of things. Nothing happened with them. But then you recorded a song called, and this was not your song. This was a song you were given. And it was called John, You've Gone Too Far This Time. And it was a response to the nude photo of John Lennon and Yoko Ono on the cover of John Lennon's album Two Virgins. And instead of it being recorded under the name Sissy Spacek, you were given the name Rainbow, spelled R-A-I-N-B-O.
Isn't that clever?
Very clever. I'm going to actually play a little bit of this song, and then we'll talk about it. So that's Sissy Spacek from very, very early in her career. So what did you make of the song when you sang it? Did you think, this is a really good song, and I certainly agree with the sentiment. John, you went too far this time.
Oh, you know, I don't even think I thought of it. It was a time in the music business with 1650 Broadway and 1619 Broadway, the Brill Building, and they called it the Bubblegum Factory that time. You know, labels would get an idea for a song. They had the name for Rainbow. All they needed was a girl. And don't remember that I made a dime on it. Maybe I made $25 for singing it. But
are you glad that your own name wasn't on this recording?
Well, actually, I thought it was an interesting recording. What I'm glad is that it didn't continue, or I would be Rainbow here talking to you now.
What a thought.
But so, it was a great experience for me, because after that I was like, up until that point I was like, well, what am I going to think of as a stage name? And after that I thought, okay, I think Sissy Spacek will be just fine.
So you never made it as a singer, but you turned to acting, and you certainly made it as an actor. And your singing especially paid off in your acting career when you played Loretta Lynn in Coal Miner's Daughter, a role which you were initially reluctant to take. Why were you reluctant to take it?
Well, because Loretta had looked, she'd been brought a stack of 8x10 glossies by the studio, and they said, go through these. These are some of the young actresses that we were thinking might be good to play you. And she got to me and she said, that's the Coal Miner's Daughter. And she'd never seen any of my work. I asked her, what was it about it? She said, I don't know. I just had a feeling. And Loretta's like that. But she was going on, she was so amazing. She was on the Johnny Carson show several times a month, and also on Merv Griffin. She was just a favorite guest. She was so darling when she was on these shows and so entertaining. Everybody loved her. And she would also always say, well, Little Sissy Spacek, she's going to play me. And I'd be watching the show, and I'd, you know, when you're young, you like to think You like to believe that you have some control over your destiny. As an older person, I realize now that that is not the case at all. But at that time, I believed that. And so when I heard this woman saying that, I was going to be like, now, just a minute. I haven't met you. I haven't made a decision about what I'm going to do. So that was why. That was why. But then I met her, and everything changed.
So let's hear a little bit of you singing as Loretta Lynn in the movie, the title song, Coal Miner's Daughter.
Well, I was born a coal miner's daughter in a cabin on a hill in Butcher Holler. We were poor, but we had love. That's the one thing my daddy made sure of. He shoveled coal a poor man's dollar. Daddy loved and raised eight kids on a miner's pay. Mommy scrubbed our clothes on a washboard every day. Well, I've seen her fingers bleed to complain, there was no need. She'd smile and mommy's understanding.
My guest is Sissy Spacek. That's an excerpt from the film Coal Miner's Daughter, in which she played Loretta Lynn. And Sissy Spacek has a new memoir called My Extraordinary Ordinary Life. How much did you have to change your style of singing to sound like Loretta Lynn?
I thought that I changed it a lot.
Well, you got that whole twangy country thing going.
Yeah, but there's something about the way Loretta... Nobody else sings like Loretta, and nobody talks like Loretta. In fact, nobody in Kentucky even sounds like Loretta. There's something that she does with her breath that's just, and her accent is just unique. And once I captured that, her rhythm, the hardest part of Coal Miner's Daughter for me was giving it all up. It was not being Loretta. I was so funny when I was Loretta. She has such a great sense of humor. But, you know, early in my career, my brother, who was in the music business with Decca Records, took me there once when I first went to New York and set up a meeting for me. That's my brother Ed, my older brother. And so all these agents filed in. I guess they weren't agents, they were executives. They all filed in, and I played my guitar and sang, and then they listened, you know, and they nodded their heads, and then they filed out, and I waited. And a little bit later, one of them came back in, and they said, you know, we have another artist that's very much like you, Loretta Lynn. And I was probably 18 at the time, and I was like, I do not sound like Loretta Lynn. And who's Loretta Lynn? But I thought that was pretty funny later in life.
Sissy Spacek speaking with Terry Gross. You can listen to more of their conversation on our website, freshair.npr.org. The German word Schadenfreude refers to the notion of taking pleasure from the troubles of others. Some literary wits, eager to see writer Nell Freudenberger stumble, have coined the term Schadenfreudenberger. While she was still in her 20s, Freudenberger garnered awards from Penn and the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says that anyone waiting for Freudenberger to take a fall will have to keep on waiting. Here's her review of Freudenberger's latest book, The Newlyweds.
There continues to be a lot of talk about gender bias in the book industry. The argument goes that while both male and female authors write novels about relationships and the domestic sphere, when a woman does so, her books are relegated to chick lit. And when a man, like Jonathan Franzen, does, he's lauded for serious literary achievement. The covers of books written by men are starker, telegraphing importance, while women's book jackets feature soft-focus Mary Cassatt-type pictures of women and children. And statistically, men's books tend to command more attention through reviews and interviews. All legitimate, even self-evident criticisms, except when it comes to exceptions, like Nell Freudenberger. from the time she broke into The New Yorker at age 26 with her first ever published short story, Freudenberger has been regarded as a heavyweight literary phenom, particularly for her 2003 short story collection, Lucky Girls. Her latest novel, The Newlyweds, features a dignified cover illustration of birds' heads, and it's already generated a ton of reviews, including the coveted front page of the New York Times Book Review. Granted, Freudenberger hasn't landed on the cover of Time magazine yet, but surely Jonathan Franzen must be looking over his shoulder. The latest feather in Freudenberger's cap is a novel called The Newlyweds, and even those who begrudge her success will have to admit that it's really, really good. As always, Freudenberger is fascinated by culture clash, here encapsulated in the marriage of our main character, a young woman from Bangladesh named Amina, and an American engineer from Rochester, New York, named George, who's 10 years her senior. This is not a love match. Lonely George wants a family. Amina, a dutiful only child, recognizes that her aging parents' security depends upon her making a good marriage, particularly since her father is something of a Bengali Willie Loman. Here, in one of the many passages of this evocative novel that swirl together wry and melancholy notes, is Amina's reflection on meeting George via a website called AsianEuro.com. Their courtship had more in common with Amina's grandparents, which had been arranged by a professional matchmaker in their village, than it did with her parents, who'd had a love marriage. Her grandparents hadn't seen each other until their wedding day, but they had examined each other's photos. She had thought of her grandmother the day she had finally received George's photo as an email attachment. His face was flawed by a certain compression of features, leaving large, uncolonized expanses of cheek and chin. His hair was a faded straw color, and his skin was so light that even Amina had to admit that it was possible to be too fair. As anyone who's read Freudenberger's work will expect, The Newlyweds is so much more than a lost-in-translation romp. There are soulful depths to the sociology here. Both Amina and George had been in love with other people before they resorted to international computer dating. And the novel, which roams in a twisting, lavish storyline between America and Bangladesh, explores the strong and sometimes disastrous pull of those earlier attachments. The Newlyweds also tackles the promise of America and the payment, practical and psychic, it demands of immigrants. In Rochester, Amina, who's highly educated, works at Starbucks and is offered babysitting jobs, presumably because of her brown skin. When Amina returns to Bangladesh, to the neighborhood of her old school, she's overwhelmed by a sense of fragmentation. The omniscient narrator here eavesdrops on Amina, anxiously thinking to herself, "You thought that you were the permanent part of your own experience, the net that held it all together, until you discovered that there were many selves dissolving into one another so quickly over time that the buildings and trees and even the pavement turned out to have more substance than you did." A sense of dead-endedness pervades the Newlyweds, a shrugging recognition that America and the modernity it embodies may offer young women like Amina more possibilities, but not endless ones. The Newlyweds is a luscious and intelligent novel that will stick with you. Sometimes, wunderkinds like Freudenberger really deserve all the hype. And despite literary sexism and sniping, they managed to keep the wonderfulness coming.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. She reviewed The Newlyweds by Nell Freudenberger. Coming up, our conversation with Julia Louis-Dreyfus. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air Weekend. This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, will forever be known to millions as Elaine Benes, the character she played for 9 seasons on Seinfeld. But she was also an early cast member of Saturday Night Live and won an Emmy for Best Comedy Actress starring in the CBS series The New Adventures of Old Christine, which ran for 5 seasons after Seinfeld. Now she's starring in a new HBO comedy series called Veep, in which she plays Vice President Selina Meyer, a former senator struggling to exert power and influence from an office much of Washington regards as irrelevant and powerless. The series finds comedy in the awkwardness of the vice president's role and in the interactions between Meyer and her staff, who are alternately fawning and cynically ambitious. Here's a scene from Veep in which the vice president, played by Julia Louis-Dreyfus, has discovered an opening in her schedule she wants to fill. Her staff are played by Anna Klumsky, Matt Walsh, and Reed Scott.
Come on, let's go somewhere. Let's meet the public.
You want to normalize it?
Yes, exactly. I want to meet some regular normals. Where are we going to find them?
Photo op at the normals and the normalistas.
Yes, there's a book fair Adams
no.
Morgan.
What kind of,
no.
You're not going to get a good photo holding a book. You need some active.
It's like kids read or something. Like, read.
Kids are unpredictable. They wet their pants.
Keep it simple.
Yeah,
keep it simple. It's, ma'am, frozen yogurt. All right, is huge in this town right now. All right, it's hot out. Let's go to a store. There's one that I know that I go to all the time on U Street. It's owned by 3 generations of African Americans. I mean, there's a narrative built right in.
Excellent. Home it's run. Perfect. Done deal.
Great.
We can totally normalize with those guys. That's what we're going to do. Make it happen, guys.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus, welcome back to Fresh Air. How did you prepare for this role, being the vice president?
I met with a lot of people on Capitol Hill. I met with a couple of vice presidents, speech writers, lobbyists, chiefs of staff in various offices, senators, schedulers, you know, the list goes on. I watched a lot of C-SPAN, and I've met some politicians, you know, along the way in my life, even prior to this project.
As you had these conversations with politicians and political operatives and staff members, give us a sense of what you learned then, or what kind of questions you asked and what tips you picked up or insights that helped inform your performance.
I'm very much struck by how insular Capitol Hill and the land of politics is, not dissimilarly from show business, to tell you the truth. You know, it sort of feels like it's the only universe when you're there. I remember a woman who was a scheduler for a senator saying really very proudly that she slept with her BlackBerry on her pillow right next to her head just in case she was needed while she was sleeping. And I thought that that was extraordinary and that she was boasting about it.
Right.
And I just thought that is amazing.
Your character is she's the vice president. We don't learn what political party your character, Selina Meyer, is. Not that much about her political career and kind of inherently has ambitions that maybe exceed her talents. But she can't be a fool either. I mean, nobody who gets to be vice president doesn't have something on the ball and some accomplishments. I wonder, as you developed this, was there sort of a sweet spot you had to find between someone who is competent but maybe not too competent and kind of neurotic?
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, buffoonery is funny, let's face it. And you'll see as the series sort of unfolds, you will see her behave competently in certain situations. But she's betwixt and between, you know. She is somebody who's used to power. She's in a powerful position, and yet she's powerless at the same time. And I play it as if that circumstance has a way of paralyzing her. So that's how I sort of justify maybe certain so-called hiccups that she has. You know, her agenda is often clashing with the agenda of the president. And how does one survive under those circumstances? It's a mess. And if it weren't a mess, it wouldn't be funny, of course. So, you know, we keep it messy.
Right, right. I thought we'd listen to another clip. In this scene, you have just, as the vice president, have just met with a senator who you're trying to get to support a bill that you're backing. And it kind of didn't go as planned. And you've just come back from the meeting and are kind of confessing what happened to your staff. The staff members here are played by Reed Scott, Anna Klumsky, and Matt Walsh. And you speak first. Let's listen.
Hey, I think I did the right thing, but I just need you to confirm that I did the right thing. I said something to someone.
What exactly did you say, ma'am, and to who?
To whom?
Senator Doyle said that he would sponsor the bill.
Oh.
If we keep oil off of clean jobs. And there was an implication, perhaps.
You didn't say yes.
No, I didn't say yes. I said, yeah.
Okay, well, we told oil we'd put one of their guys on clean jobs. That's why we got away with the cutlery
tweet. I know.
Okay.
She's aware. Okay, I was charmed by Doyle. He's got that little twinkle in his eye. He just niced me. I got nice. All right? And where were you, Amy, by the way? Where were you?
No, you said you had it covered.
No, I didn't have it covered, and it's your job to know that if I say I have it covered, I don't have it covered, and you cover me. I need you all to make me have not said that. I need you to have make me unsaid it.
That is our guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as the vice president in the new series Veep. They're trying to straighten things out with her staff. I mean, very, very funny scene.
Thanks.
You can imagine this character as a senator, when she had her own base of power and kind of more sure of where she was, handling a negotiation with another senator well. But here, she's kind of undermined by her position and gets frantic and does stupid things.
Exactly. In fact, in the first episode, when she has a meeting with Senator Hallows, played by the marvelous Kate Burton, and she comes in and she says, "Barbara, what have I been missing here?" And Senator Hallows says, "Power." When she says that, I sort of played it like it was like a punch to the gut, because it was a very brief, tiny punch to the gut that was sort of relayed, but it was in fact that, because she's sort of speaking the truth, and that throws Selena off her game, and she's off her game for the rest of that scene as a result. She's sort of struggling to get her balance back, and she doesn't quite recover it.
You were, and if I have the story right, folks at Saturday Night Live saw you in the Practical Theater Company and invited you to join the cast at the age of 21, is that right?
Yeah, that's it.
Yeah. I mean, this must have been a dream come true.
Well, it was. It was because also understand that I was in high school watching Saturday Night Live when it had just begun, you know, when it was Belushi and Gildon and Danny Aykroyd and all those guys. And so I was, you know, their audience. And then all of a sudden to be picked to be on the show was just like, it was Cinderella going to the ball time, you know.
But I gather the ball wasn't so much fun for you.
Yeah, wasn't that great?
Why not?
Well, I was very young, okay? And I was very, very naive. And I was coming from college and doing theater work with my friends, and we would all work really hard as an ensemble to make the best possible show. So there was a sort of an earnestness that I took with me to doing SNL that really had no place. I didn't understand the politics and the dynamics of the show. I also went in thinking that I would just work with writers, and I didn't go in with characters that I had worked on. I was not a writer myself. I was somewhat unprepared. Larry David was there my third year. He was a writer on that show for my last year, and it was his only year. And we became friends during that period of time. He was miserable. He didn't get a single sketch on. He did get one sketch on, but it was cut between dress and air. And so we sort of bonded in misery, and there you go.
And that's what led to Seinfeld, right?
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, there was a period of time in between, but yeah, it did.
Well, let's listen to a clip. This is, I think, from season 5, and it's a moment where Jerry arranged a date for you with a friend of his, and then on the date, the guy exposed himself, and you remember this one? And you're in the apartment after the date, and Jerry asks you about it. Let's listen.
Come on, how was your date?
Oh, the date.
Yeah, how was it?
Interesting.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Why, what happened?
Let's see. How shall I put this?
Well, just put it.
He took it out.
Oh. He what?
He took it out.
He took what out?
It.
He took it out?
Yes, sirree, Bob.
He couldn't.
He did.
Well, you were involved in some sort of amorous...
No.
You mean he just...
Yes.
Are you sure?
Oh, quite.
There was no mistaking it?
Jerry.
So you were talking, you're having a pleasant conversation, and then all of a sudden...
Yeah.
It.
It.
Out.
Out.
Well, I can't believe this. I know Phil. He's a good friend of mine. We play softball together. How could this be?
Oh, it be. You got any other friends you want to set me up with?
And that is our guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, as Elaine Bennis on Seinfeld there with Jerry. Gosh, what a fun scene.
Yeah.
The premise of the bit is funny, but... the back and forth with you and Jerry and the way you read those lines are really what make it. I mean, did you practice a lot? Did you develop those different, you know, vocal inflections and expressions?
I love the compliment. Thank you very much. But I will say that I think that scene is exceptionally well written. and it was really a question of how not to mess it up. Because that was just... that was just so artful, that writing, as I was listening to it. I remember the tricky part with that scene was that, you know, it's that scene in particular, is it all about timing in a weird kind of way. Mm-hmm. I mean, obviously, all comedy is about timing, but this scene in particular had a rhythm to it. And then you had to factor in the laughs into the rhythm. The laughs of the audience. And I remember that night as we were shooting it, thinking, this is not as we rehearsed it because of the laughs. And believe me, I'm not complaining, but it did alter things a little bit, you know? There were pauses there that we didn't really have, as I recall, in rehearsal because, you know, we weren't holding for the laugh. But it had a sort of... it was a little bit arch, that scene, I think, the way it was written. A good arch, by the way, but arch.
Now, someone said that, you know, the character of Elaine evolved a bit over the course of the series, and someone wrote that the writers found when they started writing for Elaine as if she was just one of the guys, it somehow really clicked. Does that make sense to you?
Mm-hmm. Totally, yeah. And I loved that because it opened up everything. All of a sudden, we're all on the playground together. You know, I wasn't in a separate area. Mm-hmm. And the whole idea of gender sort of not being an issue was one of many strengths of the Seinfeld show. And I think in particular, I think of the episode, The Contest, and that was the episode in which all four characters entered a contest in which they would try to refrain from masturbating. And by the way, never use the word masturbate in the entire show, which was lots of fun, too.
Yeah, it's a memorable episode.
memorable episode. But what was great is that Elaine was a part of this contest. And that was just how it was. And I was very proud to be a member of the contest. and by the way, when we were shooting that episode, I swear to you, I was every instant looking over my shoulder waiting for somebody from NBC to come and shut us down. And they didn't, inexplicably.
Well, maybe we should just listen to a bit of that scene in the coffee shop where you guys are making plans. Let's listen.
All right, I'll tell you this, stuff. I am never doing that again.
What? You mean in your mother's house or all together?
All together.
No, like,
yeah. Right.
Come on. You don't think I can?
No chance.
You think you could?
Well, I know I could hold out longer than you.
Care to make it interesting?
Sure, how much?
$100?
You're on.
Wait a second. Count me in on this.
You?
Yeah.
You'll be out before we get the check.
I want to be in on this, too.
No.
Why?
Because you're a woman.
So what?
Who
It's easier for a woman not to do it than a man. We have to do it. It's part of our lifestyle. It's like shaving.
Oh, that is such a baloney. I shave my legs.
Not every day.
All right, look, you want to be in?
Yeah.
You got to give us odds. At least 2-1. You got to put up $200.
No, 1,000.
Now, I'll put up 150.
All right, you're in for 150.
Okay, 150.
All right, now.
And that's our guest, Julia Louis-Dreyfus, with the cast of Seinfeld in a famous episode from the series. Well, you had a hit with New Adventures of Old Christine. You won the Emmy for Best Actress in a Comedy Series. And this ran for 5 seasons. Elaine Benes and Christine from New Adventures are both, you know, working women and really kind of insecure. Is there comedy in the insecurity?
Absolutely. There's no comedy in insecurity. And I don't think there's any comedy in things working out well. Conflict is where what's interesting, and I love playing that undercurrent of a lack of confidence. I think I can tap into it very easily, and but yeah, insecurity is great fun.
You know, I have to ask: Are you really insecure as an actress? I mean, most people will never have a hit like Seinfeld.
Yes, I am insecure. Of course I am. Who isn't? Who isn't insecure? Can I just say that? Who isn't? And also in showbiz particularly, you know, you sort of, it's kind of an unforgiving business, in case you hadn't noticed. So it's like whatever your last job is, sort of like, is, you know, are you in? Are you out? I mean, it's very fickle and it can be very nasty and, you know. So that plays into the security thing for sure, you know. I mean, I fight it. I try not to give it any credence or anything like that. But, you know, easy come, easy go.
Julia Louis-Dreyfus stars as the vice president in the new HBO series Veep. You can listen to a longer version of our conversation online at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air Weekend was produced by John Myers. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our associate producer for online media is Melody Kramer. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air Weekend.